Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is September 25th, 1976, and this is my monthly audio letter number 16. Last month, I recorded monthly audio letter number 15 much earlier than normal, on August 2nd, because of its extreme urgency. In that tape, I revealed the locations of multiple warhead missiles and hydrogen bombs, which had been planted by the Soviet Union in the coastal waters of 25 countries around the world, especially the United States, Canada, the British Isles, and Western Europe. We were on the threshold of a worldwide Pearl Harbor-type surprise nuclear attack, and yet no one in the federal government had taken any official action whatsoever to respond to my warnings about this terrible war threat. It was obvious that nothing would be done in time unless public opinion forced it to be done, and so I appealed to you. I told you the truth about our desperate situation, and I asked you to bring about the rescue of our beloved country by applying the kind of pressure on the government that only aroused informed citizens can bring to bear. Your overwhelming response was a major shock to the United States government, and as a direct result of your efforts, action has been and is being taken. Thanks to you, the missiles and bombs in American waters, which I revealed in monthly audio letter number 15, have been removed by the United States Navy. Likewise, those around the British Isles and a number of other locations worldwide have also been removed. But the grim fact is, my friends, that we are still in very grave danger because the Soviet Union is not giving up. That means you and I must not give up either. The Soviet Navy is now struggling and maneuvering around the clock, trying to reestablish a commanding strategic position for attack, because an imminent nuclear attack on our country is still planned by the Soviets. If this attack is to be prevented, two things must be done. First, they must be prevented from achieving the decisive edge in battlefield position, which they are now trying very hard to accomplish at sea by means of submarines. And second, the fact that the Soviet Union is preparing to plunge the world into thermonuclear war must be completely exposed, not only here in America, but worldwide. As I pointed out last month, in monthly audio letter number 15, the audacious worldwide naval surprise attack, which is almost ready to be triggered, makes the Soviet Union the all-out enemy of every other nation on earth. Once this becomes known, Russia's military posture will be very awkward indeed. In order to bring you up to date on the events of recent weeks, my three topics today are: topic number one, the August missile crisis of 1976. Topic number two, the United States intelligence gap and a new round of Soviet underwater missiles. And topic number three, the undeclared submarine war now underway. Topic number one. An increasing number of public figures in our country know about the Soviet underwater missiles ringing our country. But so far, only one has come close to warning you about it. At the Republican National Convention on August 19, 1976, Ronald Reagan was invited to the speaker's platform to say a few words following the nomination acceptance speech by President Ford. After some opening words of a personal nature and brief comments about the party platform he had helped to forge, he turned to what was really on his mind, He began, and I quote, "If I could just take a moment, I had an assignment the other day. Someone asked me to write a letter for a time capsule that is going to be opened in Los Angeles 100 years from now, on our tricentennial. It sounded like an easy assignment. They suggested I write something about the problems and issues of the day, and I set out to do so, riding down the coast in an automobile, looking at the blue Pacific on one side and the mountains on the other. And I couldn't help but wonder if it was going to be as beautiful 100 years from now as it was on that summer day." Unquote. With a few words about various challenges we face, he then continued, quote, "We live in a world in which the great powers have poised and aimed at each other horrible missiles of destruction, nuclear weapons that can, in a matter of minutes, arrive in each other's country and destroy virtually the civilized world we live in. And suddenly it dawned on me, those who would read this letter 100 years from now will know whether those missiles were fired. They will know whether we've met our challenge. Whether they have the freedom that we have known up to now will depend on what we do here. Will they look back with appreciation and say, thank God for those people in 1976 who headed off that loss of freedom, who kept us now 100 years later free, who kept our world from nuclear destruction? And if we failed, they probably won't get to read the letter at all, because it spoke of individual freedom, and they won't be allowed to talk of that or read of it. This is our challenge." Unquote. It is no coincidence that nuclear missiles came to Ronald Reagan's mind as he looked at the waters off the California coast. We had been in telephone contact with one another since August the 11th, and he knew all about the Soviet underwater missiles when he said those words of warning I just quoted. But most of his audience never realized what he was driving at, thanks to the total absence of any other clues about the Soviet threat from the government or the major media. So the fate of our beloved nation, and therefore of the whole world, rested during the month of August 1976 in the hands of those who heard my charges and acted on them. Here is what happened. During August, the United States government came under steadily mounting pressure from people like yourself all over the world, who sent copies of my tapes, relayed my charges, and demanded action. The first sign that this was beginning to take effect came on August 14, 1976. On that date, I learned that a secret code name had been assigned to the Soviet underwater missile program. However, action to remove the missile still had not been approved, and was not going to be approved unless such action was forced by public opinion. Meanwhile, the first concrete action in the August missile crisis of 1976 was taken, not by the United States, but by Canada. On August 17, 1976, the Canadian Navy had found the Crescent Beach missile near Vancouver, British Columbia, but lacked the capability to retrieve it. Prime Minister Trudeau, receiving no cooperation from the United States government at that time, called Soviet Chargé d'Affaires Nikolai Makarov in Ottawa and demanded that the Soviet Union itself come and remove the missile. And remove it they did. On August 25th, the Vancouver area was visited by three Soviet ships, two destroyers, the Sposobny and the Gnefny, and a tanker called the Ilim. Rear Admiral Vladimir Varganov arrived aboard one of the ships, using this goodwill visit as a cover. By the following afternoon, Canadian divers confirmed that the missile was gone. Meanwhile, Great Britain had also begun taking serious action in order to rid herself of the 12 underwater missiles and bombs ringing the British Isles. On August 18, 1976, Prime Minister Callaghan called a special cabinet meeting at 11 a.m. London time. Present were the First Lord of the Admiralty, the first Sea Lord of the Admiralty, and several fleet commanders. The purpose of the meeting was to listen to my monthly audio letters number 14 and 15, which had gone to England by diplomatic pouch. They already knew that my information was accurate because of the Soviet missile discovered the previous day in the waters near Vancouver. So the Royal Navy wasted no time in taking action. By August 27, 1976, all but one of the missiles had been removed, and that one, too, was retrieved shortly thereafter. By late August, the United States was at last taking action, too, prodded into it by still building public pressure. For once, President Gerald Ford acted on his own, overruled Rockefeller agent Henry Kissinger, and gave the go-ahead for the Soviet bombs and missiles surrounding the United States to be removed. Having been unleashed at last, the United States Navy worked fast, acting on the information in my monthly audio letter number 15. By the evening of August 26, 1976, seven of the Soviet weapons in our waters, six missiles and one hydrogen bomb had been removed. And by August 31, 1976, the waters along the American coastline had all been cleared. At this point, the threat to the United States that I had spelled out last month had been eliminated at last, using the very information I had made public. But the government in general, and the military in particular, were still under heavy public pressure, and under the assumption that the Soviet threat was now over and done with, they chose a technique which has become standard practice in Washington today. It's called plausible denial, a particular type of bureaucratic double talk. The Joint Chiefs of Staff and the United States Navy had just completed an operation to remove the missiles around our country, a job potentially so hazardous as to defy imagination. In short, they had done their duty, and the Navy especially deserves our thanks for accomplishing their task without anyone being hurt. They should be acclaimed as heroes, and our whole nation should be rallying behind them with justified pride. But, my friends, in the nightmare world of step-by-step surrender to the Soviets, called détente, it doesn't work that way. Even our military leaders are so thoroughly hemmed in by the one world web that the only way that they can do their duty in the face of such a Soviet threat is to hide the fact that they are doing it. And so, as soon as the missile removal operation had been completed around our shores, plausible denials of my charges began being issued by the United States military. This began on August 31, 1976, when Vice Admiral B.R. Inman, Acting Director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, answered an inquiry sent to the Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld weeks before by Senator Harry F. Byrd, Jr. of Virginia. Admiral Inman's letter gives a number of arguments as to why any prudent government, including the USSR, would presumably refrain from planting such missiles and bombs in our waters. But the real crux of his plausible denial letter is the following sentence, quote, "There is currently no evidence indicating the Soviets have placed underwater nuclear devices, including missiles with multiple warheads, within the territorial waters of the United States," unquote. Technically, Admiral Inman was telling the truth, because as of August 31, 1976, when he wrote this letter, all the evidence, the missiles and bombs, had been removed from our waters. But the impact of his letter, if read casually, would seem to be that my charges never had been true. By the same token, General George S. Brown, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, wrote me the following day on September 1, 1976. His letter has been photocopied and sent all over the world by the Pentagon. I will now read it in its entirety. "Dear Dr. Beter, your recent tape report alleging that Soviet nuclear warheads and hydrogen bombs have been planted in the coastal waters of the United States has been brought to my attention. I have investigated these assertions and find not a shred of truth to any of your statements in this regard. Let me assure you of this country's capability to detect any such aggressive actions by the Soviet Union or any other world power. We stand ready to evaluate and comment in advance on any such information you may acquire in the future which impinges upon the vital issue of our national security. Sincerely, George S. Brown, General, USAF. Unquote. The seeming impact of General Brown's letter, read casually, is that my whole story about the missiles was a fake. But the real key, once again, is the word find, present tense. Furthermore, in the last sentence, General Brown actually signaled me that the door would be open if I acquired more such information. And by the time his letter reached me, I had more such information, because, as I said before, the Soviet Union is not giving up. Topic number two. On the afternoon of September 7, 1976, I received General Brown's letter of September 1st, which I just read you. Ironically, I also learned on the same day, September 7th, that round two of the Soviet underwater missile crisis was just beginning. Three underwater missiles were now threatening Los Angeles, and San Diego was once again targeted by an underwater missile close by. Accordingly, I answered General Brown's letter as follows. Dear General Brown, today I received your letter of September 1st. I fully understand the position you are taking at this time. However, other governments have not taken your position. They know the truth. I know the truth, and so does President Ford. And the truth is that during the month of August 1976, a surprise Soviet nuclear attack of worldwide proportions has been partially averted. Make no mistake, the huge buildup of Soviet nuclear missiles on land and in the sea worldwide continues to be a clear and present signal for an imminent surprise attack of immense proportions. In 1962, we had a Soviet missile crisis in Cuba. In 1971, we had the Soviet missile crisis in Canadian and United States territorial waters, which was kept from the American people. And now, once again, in 1976, the world is experiencing yet another Soviet missile crisis. The world must know of the courage of President Ford as Commander-in-Chief in moving aside unbelievable obstacles in order to begin to meet the Soviet challenge last month. In your letter, you state that, quote, we stand ready to evaluate and comment in advance on any such information you may acquire in the future which impinges upon the vital issue of our national security, unquote. In view of this and the urgency of the situation, I respectfully request to meet with you privately in your offices within the next 10 days. At that time, I will present evidence of the validity of all my charges, and under specific conditions, I will advise you of other strategic locations of Soviet nuclear missiles planted in our coastal waters and elsewhere, of which you may not be aware, and which constitute a clear and present danger to our national security. Sincerely yours, Peter Beter. Shortly after my registered letter reached the Pentagon, Navy Captain Sidney V. Wright, Jr. called on behalf of General Brown to arrange a meeting with the General. We agreed on meeting in General Brown's offices at 3 p.m., Thursday, September 16th. An associate accompanied me to the meeting as a witness, and promptly at 3 p.m., the meeting began with General Brown and Captain Wright, who tape-recorded the meeting with my consent. In spite of the public posture which he has so far had to maintain, General Brown told me that he had overruled his staff in order to meet with me, and although he couched many of his comments with considerable care, our discussion lasted for well over an hour, without interruptions, without telephone calls, and without any cutoff because of time. I gave General Brown a special tape for his ears only, revealing the locations of 48 new missiles threatening the United States. And within 2 days, the United States Navy was already at work removing them. In addition, General Brown made 3 commitments to me, and I made 1 to him. To fulfill my own commitment, I sent the following registered letter to him on September 17, 1976. Dear General Brown, thank you for affording me the opportunity to meet with you in your offices yesterday for over an hour. During our conversation, I mentioned that the Soviet nuclear device, which was removed from Seal Harbor, Maine, had been taken to a location near Otis Air Force Base on Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and that it was still there as of the time of my meeting with you yesterday afternoon. You requested that I provide you with details about its location. The facts are that the Seal Harbor nuclear device was in the process of being retrieved by the United States Navy late Saturday, 28 August 1976, and was on the beach at Seal Harbor waiting transportation by the afternoon of 29 August. That evening, it left Seal Harbor by truck, which took it to an airport at Augusta, Maine. On the afternoon of 30 August, the nuclear device was flown from Augusta, Maine to Otis Air Force Base, Cape Cod, where the airplane touched down at 1713 EDT, 30 August 1976. From Otis Air Force Base, this nuclear device was transported to a remote location on the west side of Buzzards Bay. For over 2 weeks, the device stayed in that location, which is between 1 and 2 miles east of the small town of Marion, Massachusetts, on a small peninsula, the tip of which is known as Butler's Point. The coordinates are 41 degrees, 42 minutes, 0 seconds north, 70 degrees, 43 minutes, 30 seconds west. The Seal Harbor weapon remained there until about 2200 EDT last night, 16 September 1976. But then, less than 6 hours after my meeting with you, yesterday afternoon, it left this location. As of today, this weapon is in a new location, about 24 miles west of New London, Connecticut, with the approximate coordinates 41 degrees, 19 minutes, 0 seconds north, 72 degrees, 31 minutes, 0 seconds west. If I had not known about this latest move, the result would have been an echo of your letter to me of 1 September 1976, in which you state that you, quote, find, unquote, no evidence to support my charges. Your letter of 1 September 1976, of course, was written 43 days after I first made my charges, and only hours after the Soviet missiles had all been removed by the United States Navy. Sincerely, Peter Beter, unquote. My friends, General Brown is laboring under the handicap of an intelligence gap created by none other than Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. Allied intelligence sources inform me that they have become gun-shy in sharing some of the information they give me with the official intelligence community of the United States, because invariably Kissinger betrays it immediately into the hands of the Soviet Union. Large segments of the United States intelligence establishment are so independent that they do not consider themselves accountable even to the President. Instead, they work under the direction of Henry Kissinger, who owes his power to the 4 Rockefeller brothers and who also works in the interest of the Soviet Union. Of course, many of our intelligence people are still patriotic and loyal to our country, and they are doing everything they possibly can to protect our nation. Through their efforts, the Joint Chiefs of Staff first learned about 90 days ago that missiles and bombs had been planted in American waters by the Soviet Union. But due to the intelligence gap, they were unable to obtain complete information about them. Only when I publicly revealed this information last month did they obtain it, And even then, had I related to them privately instead of making it a public issue, Kissinger would still have been able to block any action to remove them. The signs of our growing intelligence gap are all around us. A few years ago, the United States was believed to be far, far ahead in multiple warhead technology for missiles. Yet as far back as 1971, as I revealed in monthly audio letter number 14, short-range Soviet missiles with multiple nuclear warheads were found in our own waters. A few years ago, no real threat in naval aviation was anticipated from Russia. But 2 months ago, July 1976, the first Soviet aircraft carrier, Kiev, entered the Mediterranean through the Bosphorus Straits, boldly violating the 1936 Montreux Convention as it did so. And instead of the stubby little aircraft the Pentagon had expected, the Kiev carries sleek, advanced aircraft comparable to the American F-4 Phantom, with the additional capability of vertical takeoff. And the Soviets are building at least four more carriers like the Kiev. It is now in the North Sea to bolster Soviet air power, which is a weak spot in that area for them. The military philosophy of détente, as expressed to me by a very high military official, is, and I quote, "We watch what they're doing, and they watch what we're doing, and that's good. It prevents miscalculations," unquote. But, my friends, this means we are in a perpetual war game with all of our lives at stake. And because of the intelligence gap that now exists, a miscalculation cannot be prevented. Instead, it becomes inevitable, and with it, thermonuclear war.